Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we hear the two keynote speakers from a recent conference sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University, entitled The U.S. and Europe, Partnership or Competition. Our first speaker is Alain Juppé, mayor of Bordeaux and former prime minister of France. Juppé's speech looks at the differences between European and American perspectives on the Middle East. Later in the program, we'll hear from Wolfgang Ischinger, German ambassador to the United States. We'll begin with opening remarks from Boston University President Emeritus John Silber.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm pleased to welcome to Boston University and to the Institute for Human Sciences International Conference. It's convened on the topic of the United States and Europe, partnership or competition. I'm pleased that our distinguished speakers, Mr. Alain Juppé and Ambassador Wolfgang Ischinger, have joined us. We know that recent events have given the United States and Europe a chance for a fresh start, both in moves toward Middle East peace and in transatlantic cooperation. I hope that this conference will contribute to restoring more harmonious relations between the United States and Europe, allowing them to cooperate in regions of strategic importance and tremendous upheaval. As one of the first panels on transatlantic partnership to be held since President George W. Bush's re-election, we have an advantage in our conference that President Bush has always enjoyed. We began with extremely low expectations for success. America and Europe's mutual incomprehension have reached new heights, as was seen in the European coverage of the recent campaign. Shortly after election, I was listening on shortwave, as I frequently do, to Deutsche Welle. To my disbelief, a contributor suggested, neither in jest or as hyperbole, that we might now see the burning of witches and crosses across the United States. I realize that Deutsche Welle is not the official voice of the German government, but it is unnerving to think that any European journalist or scholar or even moderately competent observer could believe that America as a nation is on the verge of reviving both the Salem witch trials and the Ku Klux Klan. In October, the British newspaper, The Guardian, noted that the American presidential election hung in the balance and that the swing state of Ohio might make the difference. In 2000, George W. Bush had won the state by a narrow plurality of just under 50%. Al Gore had won 14 of the most populous counties of the state's 88. But in one county, Clark County, Gore had won by just 324 votes. In an act of international solidarity with the Kerry campaign, The Guardian asked readers to write Clark County residents, urging them to vote against George W. Bush. The Guardian provided instructions on finding email addresses of residents of Clark County and published sample letters from three British grandees. Their pleas were insistent. I quote, "Give us back the America we love," John Le Carré wailed, "and your friends will be waiting for you." Lady Antonio Fraser, an historian, begged Ohioans to reject, and I quote, "a savage, militaristic foreign policy which has stained the great name of the United States so hideously in recent times." Biologist Richard Dawkins argued that America had become a pariah state and that the world was counting on America to vote out the, quote, "smirking gunslinger." "Please," Dawkins pleaded, "don't let us down." Dawkins et al. Were very soon disappointed. After 11,000 British citizens dutifully responded by sending their pleas across the ocean, Bush's vote in Clark County jumped 25%. Clark was the only county in Ohio that Gore had won in 2000, but that shifted to Bush in 2004. Responses from Americans to The Guardian show why. The most polite response was ironic. Tugging his forelock, one citizen asking for advice suggested that his British correspondent, and I quote again, "Please remember that I'm merely an American. That means I'm not very bright. It also means I have no sense of culture or history. It also means that I'm barely literate, so please don't use any big fancy words." Other respondents were not so restrained. "Hey, England, Scotland, and Wales," wrote another, We don't need limeys meddling in our presidential election. If it wasn't for America, you'd all be speaking German. A Texan observed, real Americans aren't interested in your tea-sipping opinions. Another was abusive. Living up to the stereotype that appealed so deeply to the European mind, he asked, and I quote, have you not noticed that Americans don't give two expletives what Europeans think of us? And he added, oh, yeah, and brush your teeth, you animals. The Daily Mirror columnist Brian Reed responded in kind, condemning America as the land, and I quote, of self-righteous, gun-toting, military-loving, sister-marrying, abortion-hating, gay-loathing, foreign-despising, non-passport-owning rednecks who had reelected a radical Christian fanatic. Europeans have found some Americans to admire. Michael Moore received the Palme d'Or at Cannes for Fahrenheit 9/11. But a divide seems to be widening between Europe's opinion makers and the people that gave George Bush the first majority any American presidential candidate has won since 1988. Given this atmosphere, it seems clear that the advent of any transatlantic cooperation in the coming 4 years may require a miracle. I would like to make a few modest suggestions as to how we might, in fact, come together. First, it seems time for Europe and here at home for Democrats to take the Bush administration seriously, a president derided for 4 years as an ignoramus incompetent, won a convincing majority of 3.5 million votes. Although it is a British newspaper, the Daily Mirror summarized the attitude of many in Europe and many Democrats with its headline, how can 59,054,087 people be so dumb? This attitude, I'm sorry to say, shows a disregard, a downright contempt for a critical presupposition of democracy, that is, confidence in the judgment of the people and the idea that a democratic government is government by the people. Despite columnists such as Reed, Bush's majority did not come from his vote in the so-called red states. The popular illusion that states are blue or red, or that America is divided and at the cusp of a civil war, obscures the fact that all of the states in the United States are, in fact, shades of purple. In 2004, Bush won more votes than he had in 2000 in all but three of the nation's 50 states. Even here in Massachusetts, John Kerry's home state, Bush won 1,067,163 votes, 37% of those cast, and 188,661 more than Bush won against Gore in 2000. This explodes another illusion, that Bush was elected by the Christian right. There have never been more than a few thousand right-wing evangelicals here in Massachusetts, and it is absurd to suggest that nearly 200,000 Massachusetts residents were born again since the 2000 election. Europeans would do well to entertain the idea that a broad consensus of Americans from all parts of the nation, not just gun-toting rednecks or right-wing Christians, rewarded Bush for his decisive action in opposition to terrorism and terrorist states. The United Nations had temporized for a decade with Saddam Hussein, who showed his contempt for the United Nations and the civilized world by failing to respond to 17 UN resolutions, including Resolution 687 and 1284, which called for uninhibited weapons inspection on the ground. On December 10, 2001, at the request of the former French Consul General in Boston, I addressed the consequences of 9/11 to the ship's company of Le Jeanne d'Arc, a French training warship visiting Boston. I was joined on that occasion by the French ambassador, François Bougeon de Listing, who discussed 9/11 from the French point of view. He and I were in full agreement about the failure of Saddam Hussein to observe the resolutions of the United Nations, and also about the importance of the United Nations issuing an ultimatum to Saddam Hussein, commanding his observation of those resolutions. But when I added that Saddam Hussein would not acquiesce in the face of any UN ultimatum, and that military intervention would be necessary to enforce UN resolutions, the French ambassador asserted that there would be no military intervention by the United Nations because France, Russia, and China would veto any such proposal. This statement, made on December 10, 2001, and confirmed by subsequent events, reveals quite clearly why George W. Bush could not succeed in garnering multilateral support for the invasion of Iraq in the Security Council. The accusation that he acted unilaterally is baffling, since there is no act more unilateral than that of a veto. The Bush administration's decision to act without UN sanction, but with all the allies it could muster, had some salutary effects, such as convincing Libya to abandon its weapons of mass destruction. The administration had also exposed and terminated a deadly network of nuclear technology smugglers that operated from a base in Pakistan and had contacts involving many European firms. Decisive action by the Bush administration brought to light the dangerous corruption of the United Nations in the Iraqi Oil for Food program, much to the embarrassment of some French, Russian, English, and American politicians and businessmen who were on the take, and it also exposed to the embarrassment of the United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan, who has continued to block the investigation of this scandal. Public opinion to the contrary, the Bush administration has led a multilateral efforts not only in Iraq but also by securing six-party talks on North Korea's nuclear weapons program. Most important, perhaps, the Allied decision to enforce United Nations resolution saved the United Nations from impotence and irrelevance that destroyed the League of Nations. The Bush administration has, to be sure, made dreadful mistakes, mistakes that are well worth unrelenting and honest criticism in environmental issues, in economic issues, and most important, in my opinion, for the way in which the war in Iraq has been carried out. In disbanding, for example, the Iraqi army, rather than co-opting them, put 1 million men out of work and left their wives and children destitute. With this mistake, the administration created a large hostile force clearly capable of insurgency, if not outright civil war. The administration deserves to be castigated for this and many other mistakes. But has the European objectionism gone beyond helpful criticism? Americans can certainly understand why their nation, now the only superpower, is an object of resentment. As a people, we have always favored or tended to favor the underdog. But now we find ourselves reluctantly, not so much by choice as by default, in the awkward position of being the big dog, or as Germans might say, the Überhund. Europeans are beginning to recognize their shared responsibility in this development. Le Monde, for example, has editorialized, and I quote, "The Europeans must not make anti-Americanism their ideology." Complaints about the American power, the paper added, failed to acknowledge that Europe had not been willing to spend adequately for its own defense. America power, it continued, is only an echo of Europe's impotence. Le Monde's comments suggest that the future is open for new possibilities. Europe and the United States still have much in common and much commonly to defend. They now have opportunities to renew their alliances, especially around questions of the Middle East. As events in Spain and more recently in the Netherlands have made plain, all of the countries of Europe are threatened by terrorist attacks by Muslim extremists. Saudi Arabia has financed the madrasas, these Quran schools, not only in the Middle East but also throughout the world, that have brainwashed young Muslims to seek martyrdom through suicide bombings or other acts of violence. This common threat may be the stimulus for rebuilding our alliances. We know the dangers that we face, political, military, nuclear, economic, and ideological. We know they pose a genuine threat to our lives, our liberties, and our prosperity. The seriousness of the present situation and the importance of unity between the United States and Europe in addressing these problems underscores the importance of this conference. I hope this will prove to be the beginning of a renewed and reinvigorated partnership. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me first thank Boston University, John Silber, and I listen with much attention to John Silber's speech, a speech very frank, as we say in diplomatic sector. I perfectly understand, Mr. President, your surprise when you read some newspaper in France or in Germany or in Europe about American policy. But I hope you also understand our surprise when we are reading some American newspapers about Europe. And the Monde wishes that anti-Americanism will not become the ideology of Europe. May I wish that French bashing will not be your ideology on this side of the Atlantic Ocean. I was also interested in contributing to a discussion on the Middle East. I consider this issue to be crucial for peace and security, not only in the region, but more globally. Stability and prosperity in the Middle East will affect us all. Moreover, I am convinced that there is no fundamental disagreement on this point between the two sides of the Atlantic. Our difference of view do concern the means to achieve our goal, not the goal itself. I should like to start, by way of an introduction, by tracing the multitude of ties which, from time immemorial, have linked Europe to that part of the world and which underpin what is today called the Euro-Mediterranean space. We are close, not only geographically, we are also close historically. The very name of Europe illustrates the exchanges between the two banks of the Mediterranean, and without going back to mythological times, it is worth remembering the magnificence of the Umayyad Caliphate in Spain, the trade relations between developed by Venice with the East, the importance of the Arab writers and scholars in the rediscovery of Greek authors, not forgetting the role played by the Jewish communities scattered around the Mediterranean in the dissemination of science and the arts. The Mare Nostrum has always been an area of commercial, cultural, and human exchange. Such exchanges, often peaceful, occasionally belligerent, continue today, as shown by the Mediterranean influence found, for example, in France, in literature, music, or even in gastronomy. We have often shared our place in the history books with those countries, including, at times, some dark pages, and have shared a common language, as French is widely spoken in that part of the world. The Middle East is a zone where the international community's anxieties are most frequently focused. It is not secret that such worries are exacerbated by our energy dependence on a region which holds 65% of the world's oil reserves and where conflicts and clashes, which recently pushed the price of oil to over $55 a barrel, have a direct impact on the growth rate of our economies. What are our main concerns today? Iraq, first, obviously. Without sowing dissension, I nonetheless consider that it can be safely said that the objective we all share of a democratic, peaceful, stable, and prosperous Iraq has, unfortunately, not yet been reached. To achieve that and to solve the complex problems of a country where the checks and balances are extremely fragile, it is important to isolate the most radical elements by offering a clear political perspective to the Iraqi population. The international conference, the convening of which has been supported by France for a long time, should contribute to that end. What is happening in Iraq concerns us all. We cannot allow ourselves to fail, and we must act jointly, US and EU, to settle a crisis which endangers the stability of the entire region. Then there is the Arab-Israeli conflict. This is a running open sore which we have been living with for far too long. Since September 2000 and the start of the Intifada, fighting has resulted in over 4,350 victims, two-thirds of them Palestinians. The vicious spiral of violence and hatred has not been broken. Mutual incomprehension and the absence of any future prospects continue to fuel despair and extremism. The complexity of the problems to be solved, religion, frontiers, the status of Jerusalem, the fate of the refugees and settlers, the issue of Lebanon and Syria, should not discourage us, but on the contrary, stimulate our efforts towards a negotiated and mutually acceptable solution. It must be borne in mind that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict increases the tensions, bitterness, and frustration of the Arab world and of Muslim communities. We are all agreed today that the only possible peace is a peace seen to be fair and just, based on the coexistence of two states within safe and recognized frontiers, guaranteed security for the Israelis, and offering the Palestinians a normal and dignified life within a politically and economically viable state. Is a peace settlement impossible? All the components of a solution are on the table, and they were clearly identified on several occasions. For example, the Mitchell Report in April 2001, then the Arab League Summit in Beirut in March 2002. This summit endorsed the initiative of Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, proposing, within the framework of a global settlement, complete normalization with Israel. Later, the Geneva Initiative, which brought together prominent figures from both sides, and most importantly, the framework of the roadmap prepared jointly by the United States, Russia, the European Union, and the United Nations. What is missing today is not a peace plan. There is one, but the political determination and courage to implement it. Arafat's death may provide a new opportunity to act in that way. The proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and the spread of nuclear technology are other sources of serious concern. I'm thinking, of course, of Iran, a country with which Germany, France, and the United Kingdom have undertaken a demanding dialogue. And the idea, supported by the European Union, of creating a zone free of weapons of mass destruction and of their delivery systems in the Middle East currently appears to be purely utopian. Finally, terrorism. This hideous phenomenon is striking everywhere, from Tanzania to Pakistan, from Bali to Moscow, from Paris and Madrid to New York. It must be fought relentlessly and its roots eradicated. We must, however, be careful not to fall into the trap it lays before us by carrying too far the fears harbored by every one of us, by attempting to set nation and civilization against each other, and by provoking the syndrome of the besieged fortress, which fallaciously believes it is safe beyond barriers that merely reinforce hatred and incomprehension. We must try to understand what exactly fuels Islamic terrorism, how and why a man or a woman turns into a human bomb programmed to kill and maim innocent civilians. To attempt to address those difficult issues, we must go beyond the open crisis of Iraq and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to examine the political, economic, and social crisis affecting the Arab world and the Middle East. I could even add the moral and intellectual crisis, which, against a backdrop of a feeling of humiliation and injustice, has prepared the ground for radical Islamism, leading the holy war not only abroad, but in the very heart of Islam, as demonstrated by Gilles Kepel in his latest book entitled Fitna. Radical Islamism is spreading and terrorist actions are increasing in a degraded economic and social environment. In the Middle East, tens of millions of people, mainly women, are illiterate. The profound inadequacy of the health system is coupled with insufficient social security coverage. Unemployment is undermining a society in which the under-15s represent close on 40% of the population, twice the proportion of other countries. There has been no economic takeoff in that region. International and interzone trade remains limited, and over the last few years, the gap has widened with the average level of the OECD. For example, the GDP of the combined Arab countries remains below that of Spain. Unfortunately, the dynamic between security and economic development is well known. Insecurity hinders development, and the absence of development and prospects for progress prepares the ground for fundamentalism and terrorism. In the Arab world, the current growth rate does not make it possible to reach the level of job creations required by demographic pressure. Youngsters who are unemployed, deprived not only of resources but also of the dignity brought by a job, lose all hope in the future, becoming easy prey for the recruiters of terrorism. A poor economic performance, especially if accompanied by huge gaps in earnings and wealth, combined with the absence, and in fact sometimes the repression of any democratic expression, go to make up a very dangerous cocktail in the countries of the region. It is vital for France, for Europe, and for the US to have stable and prosperous neighbors for all us, French and European people, offering their population prospects other than immigration. No, because there is now an awareness which would result in international mobilization. Certain countries in the region, such as Morocco or Jordan, even Tunisia, have courageously embarked upon a policy of modernization. Others, such as Libya, have recently made the necessary moves to be reintegrated within the international community. I, for one, believe in the existence of a genuine aspiration of the population of those countries for democracy, human dignity, freedom, economic development, and social justice. We must, however, refrain from attempting to impose our model from the outside, with the inherent risk of offending the pride and dignity of the people concerned. We must instead support the movement, back the reforms undertaken, and accept that the process may well be different to take account of the diversity of the situations in the countries of the region. Within the European Union, France is firmly committed to this approach. Long before the United States turned their attention to the greater Middle East, the European Union in Barcelona in November 1995 launched a process for dialogue and cooperation which led to the signing of association agreements with the countries of the region. These agreements are providing financial aid to the tune of some 20 billion euros made available through the funds of the Euro-Mediterranean Development Programme, MIDA, and loans from the European Investment Bank. Following the creation of a Euro-Mediterranean Parliamentary Assembly in Athens in March 2004, the European Council made a further step forward in June of the same year by defining the basis of a strategic partnership with the Mediterranean and the Middle East, the objective of which is to promote the building of a common zone of peace, prosperity, and progress in the Mediterranean and Middle East. This partnership has several very significant aims: to promote political reforms, good governance, democracy, and human rights, to stimulate economic and commercial cooperation and the liberalization of trade, to foster the prevention and settlement of conflicts, and the means of fighting terrorism, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and illegal immigration. At this point, I would like to add some remarks about Turkey and the accession of Turkey to the European Union. The complexity of the issue for the Europeans may not always be fully understood in America. I have myself changed my mind on the subject, being first a supporter of this accession and then, now, an open sceptic. The enormous changes that Turkey has accepted because of the perspective of its accession to the European Union, a new constitution, new penal laws, the abolition of capital punishment, minorities' rights, and so on. And above all, the risk of throwing Turkey in the arms of radical extremists if we refuse its application. On the other side, Turkey poses an important question to Europe, that of its borders and consequently that of its identity. If we accept Turkey, how could we answer no to Morocco, then Algeria, Tunisia, the whole Maghreb, the links of which with some European nations are as narrow as Turkey's? And then, why not Belarus, Ukraine, and other countries of the independent state community? I believe that such an enlargement of the EU would fundamentally change our European project, the project of a political entity sharing the will of carrying out its own foreign policy and building its own security force in the framework of a friendly and frank partnership with the United States. To finish, I would like to quote Samuel Huntington, who published in Foreign Affairs in 1993 an article and stressed the interaction between Islam and the West. He said, "This interaction is perceived by both sides as a clash of civilizations. Whether it is a clash between civilization or rather between brutal and radical elements on both sides is debatable. My understanding is that both America and Europe have tried to avoid the war on terrorism to be seen as a civilization clash, and rightly so. At the same time, to avoid violence from spreading, the Muslim world should give more space for political debate, more opportunities to its youth, more emancipation to its women, and more dignity to its people. As far as we are concerned, we should take more seriously our own commitment to help political reforms in the Middle East and on both sides of the Atlantic. Everything should now be done to restart the peace process between Israelis and Palestinians. Will the new situation created by Yasser Arafat's death facilitate the reviving of the peace process between Israel and the Palestinian Authority? We all share this hope. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your kind attention.
Alain Juppé, Mayor of Bordeaux and former Prime Minister of France. You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we're hearing the two keynote speakers from a recent conference sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University, entitled The U.S. and Europe, Partnership or Competition? Introducing our next speaker, Wolfgang Ischinger, is Institute Executive Director Irina Krasinska-Gross.
The speaker is Mr. Wolfgang Ischinger, who is the German ambassador to the United States. I would like just to say a few words about Ambassador Ischinger. He is ambassador in the United States from July 31, 2001, and he joined the German Foreign Service in 1975 with a German law degree, and what is important for us here, and a master's degree from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, so he is bicostal, so to say. And he worked at the United Nations in New York and was posted in Washington and in Paris. In Bonn, he served as special assistant to foreign ministers Genscher and Kinker. He also, besides being a professional diplomat, is an intellectual and writes books and has published widely on foreign policy, security, arms control policy, as well as on European and transatlantic issues, which are of very big interest to us. But what is also very important, he's a certified professional ski instructor and holds a private pilot's license, so he's prepared to jump into our difficult discussions right away. Thank you.
Thank you so much for this warm welcome. It's a privilege and a real pleasure for me to be here for the first time at Boston University. I'm confident it's not going to be the last time. Without boring you with the development of the German-American relationship, I want to start by making one observation. I am troubled somewhat by newspaper articles in European media, as well as pieces in the American press, which seem to suggest that we have no more really things to say to one another, that we're drifting apart not only politically but also philosophically, that the European debate is a European debate fueled by European thought, by Europeans, and the American debate is exclusively and more and more an exclusively American debate. I think that that is simply not true. It seems to me that in this rather troubled period of the transatlantic relationship that we have been going through in recent months or years, the most influential voices in Europe with respect to foreign policy, with respect to the future, have been Americans. It's interesting to me, and I think we should be aware of that, that the book that has had the greatest distribution in Europe, which was written against the policies of President Bush, is not a book written by a European. It's an American by the name of Michael Moore. And interestingly enough, the book about the future, the great future of Europe, which has been on the Italian bestseller list, and I imagine it will be or is already on the German or maybe also on the French bestseller list, is a book, again, not by a European, but by an American. Jeremy Rifkin wrote a book about the great future of Europe. And in between, you have Professor Kupchan, you have Francis Fukuyama, and many others who've been having a great influence on European political thinking. So I don't think that there is an end to transatlantic thought and intellectual intercourse. I think the opposite is true. If we ask ourselves why we have had such difficulties in this period since 9/11, I would like to point out just one or two points which I think are relevant. This period, beginning with 9/11, is the first period that I'm aware of in the post-World War II era where on one side of the Atlantic there is a belief that one is at war, and on the other side of the Atlantic there is a belief that one is not at war, generally speaking. It's very hard for an alliance and for a relationship to be managed if one side believes that it has a reason to define itself as a country at war and the other half or so of that same alliance not sharing that view. When we look at the reasons why we have arrived at this situation, it is, in my view, always helpful to remember this, these two key dates in recent transatlantic history, 9/11, 2001, and 11/9, 1989, the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I think these two events, this little play of numbers, these two events are extremely meaningful because because of what happened with the end of the Cold War and with the departure of the Soviet Union and with the end of the Soviet Empire in Western and Central Europe, Europeans began to believe, rightly or wrongly, that a better, a more peaceful period in European history was beginning to arrive, finally. And here in America, of course, 9/11 was seen to be a reason to consider oneself totally at risk in a way that Americans had never thought they would be, certainly not in the recent past. I think that as a prescription for transatlantic health in the future, you manage an alliance and you manage a relationship, especially in terms of political military crisis management, much easier if you follow the principle in together and out together. In other words, if we feel that we must do something militarily, let's be sure that we decide that together, and let's be sure that we decide that we will do it together until we decide together that we will end it together. I think that is a valid point, and one that we should keep in mind as we move into the next phase. It will be much easier to manage the transatlantic relationship in the future if we try not to have a repetition of the situation that was created in the matter of Iraq, with war and not war within the transatlantic alliance. On Iraq, I would like to come to the end and just share with you one or two additional observations about what the problem is and how we might go about improving our working relationship in the months and years to come. As a practitioner of diplomacy, when I look at past crises in the transatlantic relationship, and when I compare these past difficulties that we had in the 70s, 80s, 90s to what we have today, I think there is one specific difference between what was and what is. The difference is that in our relationship today, there is, unfortunately, and I regret having to say that, there is a lack of sufficient mutual trust between both sides of the Atlantic. I don't mean to suggest to you that in the past there was always total trust. We've had French presidents who wondered about American presidents, I imagine, and we've had German chancellors who were angry at American decisions, and I'm sure vice versa. That's not what I mean. What I mean is that there was a fundamental sense that we were hanging in together in something, and we needed to be able to trust one another, and we did, and rather successfully so, over several decades. I think the current situation is one where in Europe, obviously, and some of you are from Europe and know more about it than I, in Europe there is now not the same level of willingness to trust America as there used to be. I think that is unfortunately not a disputable fact. And unfortunately, the same is true in the other direction. One does get the impression that many in America, many in Washington, simply don't believe that Europe has something amounting to a spine, that we would always be weak and not reliable when things get really difficult. So in other words, I think that rather than discuss only the specifics of what we should do on Iran or what we should or should not do on Iraq, We must keep in mind that there is a larger issue here, which is the question of how can we rebuild trust. In my own experience as a practitioner, I have to conclude that the only way of rebuilding trust is by practical experience in working together. In other words, you cannot order people to trust one another. You have to allow them to have an experience that it works. And that, ladies and gentlemen, requires concrete, specific cooperation on issues. I very much hope that as we move into a new phase of our relationship with Iran on the basis of the just concluded agreement, that America will review its position and will not deal with this European-Iranian deal on the basis of some kind of very benign neglect, but will actually come to the conclusion that this is worth supporting. And I also hope that there will be a willingness to study suggestions such as the one made recently by none other than Henry Kissinger, namely to think about establishing something that would look like a contact group, a smaller group at a very senior level that would draw both sides of the Atlantic together outside the formal forum of the NATO Council or the G8 or others. We've had such good experiences with smaller groups in the difficult days of the crisis management in the Balkans in the 1990s and on other issues. So I think that when we speak of the need to reestablish strategic dialogue, that's what American politicians, European diplomats, and vice versa have been saying to one another in recent months. We should have a better strategic dialogue. But what does that mean exactly? It cannot mean that you explain to the other side of the Atlantic your position and then add, if you agree with that, you're invited to come along. But if you don't agree with that, you know, we'll do it without you. In other words, having a real strategic dialogue requires using the institutions which we have. And using the institutions we have means, for example, taking the strategic dialogue, which we're all interested in having, for example, to the North Atlantic Council, and try to reach a consensus. I think there are enormous opportunities to do that, and we're extremely pleased, I want to say that expressly, with announcements by the President and by others from the White House about the renewed willingness to work with Europe, and I do hope that that will turn out to be the case as we move into 2005. I was thinking for when I arrived here how I could conclude my little presentation to you today. I would like to conclude by offering you a story, which I think is appropriate for this situation. It's a story which was shared with me initially by a very prominent American diplomat who is currently the head of President Bush's National Intelligence Council, Ambassador Hutchins. And 10 years ago, when we were discussing how Central Europe could conceivably emerge from the devastation of 40 years or so of communism, he told me and others the story of the two Canadian moose hunters, which I am happy to share with you here today. And it goes as follows. These two Canadians have the habit of renting a seaplane every summer, which takes them to a remote peninsula in the north of Canada where they go moose hunting. So this year again, they rent the seaplane. The pilot flies them to this remote island and lands. And the pilot says, look, you guys, we will have exactly the same procedure as the one that we had last year. You will now go hunting for 7 days. Don't forget to be back here at this spot 7 days from now. And also don't forget that this is a small plane and I can only take one moose each with me because they are so heavy. So sure enough, the pilot leaves, our two hunters go hunting for the entire week, and 7 days later, yes, the two hunters are back at this spot as agreed, and the seaplane flies in, and the pilot greets our two moose hunters and says, "But didn't I tell you that you're entitled only to one moose each? Now you have four of these big animals. How am I going to take them home?" And Jack, one of the moose hunters, says, "Come on, Bill. Last year we gave you $200 extra. So here is $300, and let's get on with it." So these heavy animals are being, you know, pushed into the hold of this small airplane, and it is very heavy in the water, and then the pilot pushes the throttle, and the airplane accelerates and actually rises from the lake and begins to climb. But you know that in Canada they have these high mountains, so unfortunately the plane doesn't quite make it and crashes into this beautiful Canadian mountain meadow. Out from under the wreck of the airplane climb our two moose hunters, rather dazed from the impact. And Jack looks around and says, "Jim, where do you think we are?" And Jim climbs out also, looks around and says, "Jack, we can't be more than 500 yards from where we crashed last year." Thank you for your patience.
German Ambassador to the U.S. Wolfgang Ischinger, speaking at a recent conference sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University, entitled "The U.S. and Europe, Partnership or Competition." Earlier, we heard from Alain Juppé, Mayor of Bordeaux and former Prime Minister of France. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Tim Skove, with help from Ian Hughes. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.